tonight on Arena. Bill Whelan on the significance of Carole King's album Tapestry, and Danielle McLaughlin on her first novel, The Art of Falling. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Tapestry by Carole King is not only one of the most commercially successful albums of all time, it marked the pinnacle of the career of one of the greatest songwriters in popular music history. Released exactly 50 years ago today, February the 10th, 1971, the album features hits like It's Too Late, So Far Away, I Feel the Earth Move, and songs that generated new fans with each passing decade. Well before it was ever written, recorded or released, Carole King had established herself as one of the great American songwriters, writing classics like Natural Woman for Aretha Franklin or Going Back for Dusty Springfield. Shortly I'll be speaking with Bill Whelan about Carole King's significance as a songwriter and the 50th anniversary of Tapestry. But let us start, as the album does, with this track. What a way to open that album, I Feel the Earth Move, from Carole King, and the album Tapestry, 50 years old exactly today. And joining me now, Bill Whelan, to talk about Carole King, that album. But to start with, Bill, an extraordinary story about your actually meeting Carole King in Dublin in the 1990s.
Yeah, actually, it was really all down to Peter Sheridan. Peter Sheridan had directed Carole in a play in Dublin at Andrews Theatre, at the Andrews Lane Theatre. And it was not something that really made massive newspaper headlines. But to those of us who knew Carole King, to know that she was around and in town, it was like a big deal. And then we were running Riverdance at the Point, and Carole turned up one night and she sent her ticket around to me, signed by her. And we met, and that led to a friendship between Carole and myself, mm-hmm. and in fact my family. And we holidayed together. In fact, you know, for me, this was extraordinary because Tapestry, you know, I remember I was 21 when Tapestry came out. And I'd moved to Dublin. I was in college in Dublin, and I just literally wore down the album playing it, and to suddenly meet Carole King was an incredible thing. You know, you can imagine. Here was one of my idols, and we became good friends. And in fact, my family, we holidayed once with Carole in her ranch in Idaho, and. On a Christmas day, we had a jam session with myself and Carole and my son and my two sons, one playing bass and the other playing drums. And I looked at them and I just wondered, have you guys any idea where you're sitting at the and who you're sitting with? You know, because Carole was all about, she was an extremely warm person. And so that's how we met. Peter Sheridan.
Well, yeah, that's a good. It's a good blame to get that one feisted upon you, I would think. And in fact, it was Carole King's birthday yesterday, I do believe, wasn't she? 79 years of age. Extraordinary stuff. But that album, as you say, Bill, sitting in her ranch and playing with your two sons in 1997, 98, you knew the significance of where you were, even if they didn't. And let's be fair to them, you might understand if they didn't fully get the significance of it.
Totally.
But bring us back to that time then, and I suppose the type of music industry that Carole King was in at that time, she'd had huge successes as a songwriter for other people.
Yeah, you know, I think Sean, this is the point about this album is that Carol and this album stands at a kind of a nexus between, if you like, the songwriter as person off in a room writing songs and delivering them into the music industry and to performers. And in many ways, okay, there were other performers who wrote their own songs around the time, but this somehow or other stands as the one where, and particularly, you know, being a female writer who also sang her own songs, it was a really important, apart from the quality of the music, which is undoubted, it was an important time, I think, in terms of what was happening in music. And if you won't remember, Sean, but in the late 1960s, you know, it was pretty a turbulent time. I was in UCD in 68, and there was a lot of sort of turbulence, and all of the American universities had kicked off, the Sorbonne in Paris. It was a turbulent time socially. And to have Carole King and James Taylor and all of those folks who were writing songs which were, you know, they weren't in the true sense like glitzy songs for the commercial music industry. They somehow or other spoke at a more personal level to the listener, you know?
Yeah, I think one of the important things that you would like to say about that personal nature, though, in some ways, Bill, is yes, they are very personal songs, but they never get into any type of, you know, narcissism, effectively. She can speak about herself without you thinking, oh, would you give over? I've heard enough about you now at this point in time.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because I was just thinking about this. I was talking to my son, who is a musician, about this earlier in the week. And we were just saying, you know, I was saying that, you know, if you look at that time and, you know, songs were really came out of that whole Tin Pan Alley in through to the Brill Building and all of that period in songwriting. And basically, songs were love songs. They were either songs about how you were falling in love or how you were falling out in love or how you were deserted or whatever it was. And Carole King, again, arrived at that point where people were starting to write picturesque kind of songs, like, for instance, in her own case, Smackwater Jack. You know, in the Beatles' case, we had the Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, Eleanor Rigby, all those many songs, which were like musical pictures, which were not about whinging about falling out of love or being deserted. Not to downplay those songs, but you know, it was a different time. And as you say, it was, you know, there's, you know, my son will argue with me about this, but both of them will. But, you know, it was a time, I think, when there was less, as you say, narcissism and less a sense of entitlement that the world should be listening to you, you know, going on about how you've been deserted or whatever. And I do think that's crept back into music. And the other thing that was important is that I think Carol, she was about to become a performing artist who was also a writer. Now, I know James Taylor encouraged her enormously in this, and she, you know, she would be the last to say that she's a brilliant pianist. She's not. But what she did was and what was done with Tapestry was really great. She was surrounded by great musicianship, and suddenly arrangements became important of these songs. Yeah. And all of the, and that's what really, I remember at the time being really taken by this, and suddenly you were paying attention to who was playing on albums, you know.
Well, let's have a listen to a song we might associate with James Taylor, in fact, but he plays on the album, on Tapestry, but it's Carole King who performs the song that, as I say, many of us will associate with James Taylor. And you know. And there's You've Got a Friend, as heard on Carole King's album Tapestry, which is 50 years old today. Bill Whelan speaking to me about the album this evening. This is one of the things that really strikes me about the album and about Carole King in general. We all know, Bill, of songwriters who have written great songs. Then they perform them themselves and you think, Doesn't sound like a great song there, does it? But when Carole King performs You've Got a Friend, even though we all know the James Taylor version he's playing in there, by the way, backing vocals on tracks on the album and guitar presumably on tracks on the album as well. When she does it, it's her song.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And just listening to it again there now, Sean, it's like it is such a standard. I mean, that song, you and I will have moved on quite a long time before that song fades. It is an evergreen. Hmm. And the thing about it, too, just listening to it just technically, is the harmonic changes, the chords that she's using, you know, they weren't everywhere around the music industry at that time. And I was just talking earlier about the whole business about how chords like that she uses, without getting too technical, you know, major sevenths and, you know, those beautiful open set of chords that were full of a kind of created a sense of warmth and hope in people when listening to them, you know, they were appearing in music at that time. And then you saw somebody like Brian Wilson with the song like God Only Knows coming along and knocking it out of the park, if you like, in terms of harmonic structure of sounds. But this was all, you know, it was all part of the development of what Joni Mitchell calls, you know, stoking the star maker machinery behind the popular song. The popular song was in growth at that time. Paul Simon was writing extraordinary songs. Jimmy Webb, who was another great idol of mine, was you know, he wrote some amazing music, you know, and he was only 20 years of age. So there was a mood abroad, and Carole caught that.
Yeah, she, you mentioned Jimmy Webb there in the age he was. When she wrote Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, which is on this album with her performing it, but the Shirelles version, I think, is probably the version that lots of people will know. She was 18 when she wrote Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow. I mean, that's just something else.
Yeah. And look at, go way back and look at the first Beatles album with Chains on it. You know, that song she wrote. Chains, my babe, it's got me locked up in chains. You know, I mean, those sort of songs, and the Little Eva, the Locomotion, all those songs that she wrote. I mean, what a glittering career of as a songwriter, as a crafting songwriter, and then finally to become make that bridge between somebody who was writing songs into a market to somebody who was writing songs for herself.
Yeah, I suppose an important thing here is the move from east to west, because that crafting songwriter, as you say, writing for other people, very much part of the Brill Building, you know, in Manhattan.
Ethos, but
that ethos was there, where you're writing for other people and the song is for them, it suits them, and off you go. But she moved to LA then and really became part of the Laurel Canyon rock scene, which included James Taylor, who we've already mentioned, and included many of the players on this album. The players are important for you, Bill.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, not least of which, I mean, Joni Mitchell is in there. I mean, look at her contribution to popular music, and also her position in the pantheon of contemporary songwriting. I mean, she is, in my view, right up there at the top of you know, Joni Mitchell, because of her ability to move seamlessly between, you know, writing poetry, in fact, and songs that can move into jazz. And also, she's a painter. I mean, she's an extraordinary, gifted person. And that was happening. There was another artist that I was thinking about today, you know, in terms of these female writers that were starting to appear. Laura Nyro was another one who came out of New York in that period, writing absolutely beautiful songs and very challenging songs musically, you know. And then, of course, along came Kate Bush and, you know, again, a new voice appearing and a new way of expressing songs. But right there, and that's why I think Tapestry, you know, so we're celebrating it today and with absolute justification, because it was, it spoke to everybody. It spoke to musicians. It spoke to, you know, because often that's difficult sometimes, you know. It spoke to musicians and it spoke to people sitting in flats and rat mines, as I was listening to it, you know, at 4 o'clock in the morning. I mean, it really was a very, very important album, I think, you know.
And the same year was, you've mentioned Joni Mitchell there, the same year we got the album Blue, which of course hugely important, Hunky Dory from David Bowie that same year as well, What's Going On by Marvin Gaye. 1971 was certainly a good year, but I'm looking at some of the instruments that are on the album. Cello, tenor saxophone, string quartet, acoustic guitar, electric guitar. But there's a kind of a violin, tenor saxophone, string bass. there's a real orchestral feel to it, but a kind of an orchestra that you could put together with a bundle of talented friends.
Well, that's exactly the point. And I think that, you know, if you look at people like Russ Kunkel and Danny Kortchmar and Lee Sklar and the people who are on that album, you know, they all sound like they were just sitting around in a room, and they were. Mm. You know, I mean, it feels like it's almost like a cottage industry album in some ways. And it feels terrible, exactly as Carol is, you know, terribly homey. I mean, Peter Sheridan was telling me he met Carol because she did the catering on one of his, on a film that he was developing. And yeah, she was doing the catering. I mean, that was the kind of person she was. She was happiest. You know, she was a hippie, let's face it. She was a hippie when hippies were cool. and she, you know, a lot of that very kind of almost like motherly way that she went on, you know, it's no accident that she wrote Natural Woman, you know. Mm. I mean, she has two beautiful daughters who I've got to know, and they're, you know, one of them's a songwriter, and they're you know, she really was and remains a unique person, but she's terribly private, and she's off there in Idaho now. And mostly what she does now is she campaigns for ecological issues. I mean, she's politically quite active.
Is any of that, I mean, you talked about the songs on this album being quite personal. Is any of the politics that you're mentioning that she's involved in now, but that she was always quite political throughout, is that, are there songs specifically on Tapestry that address those topics?
Not directly, I think. You know, songs like Way Over Yonder and stuff, you know, the songs that have some kind of hope in them, and that was very much alive at that time, that we you know, I think we all felt that maybe it was one of the disappointments of, I suppose, the hippie movement that came out of America, was that it you know, and post-Vietnam or during Vietnam, it didn't really deliver what everybody expected it might deliver. But there was that sense of hope, you know, that you didn't see on Capitol Hill in the last few weeks, you know. That was a different, that was an anger. Then there was a kind of a hope, and she was part of that, as was Taylor. And it felt, you know, in a way that country music is country, this is not urban music either. It feels more that it's moving somewhere in that urban-rural divide and crossing it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I'm listening to the album again today, you just kind of marvel at how a 50-year-old album can sound as if it was written yesterday, that it still has that kind of feel off it as well. I'm going to finish up with Feel Like a Natural Woman, because you've mentioned that a couple of times, Bill, and specifically referring to her daughters, and I suppose herself being such a natural type person from the way you've described her. What then, just to finish up on it, Bill, what would you say is the achievement of Tapestry, Carole King's album, which is 50 years old today?
Well, perhaps the big achievement is that 50 years later, we're still listening to it and enjoying it. That is the big achievement. In terms of where it stood in the musical pantheon, or where it is, it definitely, to me, was, it represented some kind of, it was a crossroads of some sort. We were moving from the craft writer to the what we saw coming up in the coming years after that. And Tapestry connected to that and definitely became a voice for that change. Now, did it deliver, as we look at it 50 years later, what has happened to music, what has happened to the kind of songs we write nowadays? Is there a lot of narcissism about it, you talked about earlier? That's a debate. But certainly Carole King, I think, showed a light about what songs can be about and what approaching songs honestly can be about.
Great. Well, listen, lovely to have spoken with you this evening. We'll have that debate another night, Bill. That'll be an interesting one for another evening. But let's finish up with Carole King. Thanks a million for that, Bill.
Okay, Sean, thank you.
Bill Whelan there speaking to us about Carole King and Tapestry. And here is Feel Like a Natural Woman.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel uninspired.
Natural Woman, you make me feel like a natural woman from Tapestry, Carole King's album, which is 50 years old today. Carole King herself, 79 years and one day old today. Yesterday was her 79th birthday, so happy birthday to her. And great to hear that song in its entirety. And you all loved that chat, in fact. Sinead Smith loving this chat about Carole King on RTE Arena. Hi, Sean. Tapestry, along with Hunky Dory and Lou Reed's Transformer, kept me company in a basement flat in Brighton in 1987. Yes, those albums got many people through the 70s and 80s. Absolutely stood as equal to those other two masterpieces. That's from Brian in Clare. It's all about the music for me today. Carole King on at RTE Arena is bliss. Hashtag Carole King, says Hilda McAvoy. And saw her in concert, says Brona, in Brighton Beach in Anders Lane Theatre. Great actress is Brona's judgment on that. And thanks very much to Bill Whelan for that. His thoughts on Tapestry, which I must say I found fascinating. Hope you did too. Danielle McLaughlin's debut collection of short stories, Dinosaur on Other Planets, was published to great acclaim in 2015 and subsequently won the Sunday Times Audible Short Story Award and the prestigious Wyndham Campbell Literature Prize for Fiction. Danielle is back in 2021 with The Art of Falling, her debut novel, set in the art world and exploring profound truths about love, power and the secrets that bind us. Delighted to have Danielle McLaughlin join us on the programme this evening. The Art of Falling, Danielle, it opens with this, with your lead character here, Nessa McCormick. She's been in a tough place, but it looks as if things are kind of beginning to come back on track.
Good evening, Sean. Well, yes, she is hoping very much that things are going to come back on track. So her marriage is coming back together in the aftermath of her husband's affair. And she's also really interested in a new project that she's involved in at work. But things become complicated for her when her past intrudes upon her present and she has some tough decisions to make.
Yeah, we'll tease out some of the ways the past comes in a moment. But I guess you talk about things being at work are quite exciting for her as well. She works as an art curator. What did that job give you as the novelist, to give that job to Nessa McCormick, your character?
It gave me the opportunity to inhabit the edges of the art world in a way that I would never inhabit them in real life. It gave me the opportunity to make sculpture without making sculpture, if you like, to bring sculpture to the page. And I found that great fun because I would have no talent for making sculpture in real life. But by having in my novel a deceased sculpture, a fictional one, and by having Nessa in charge of a retrospective exhibition of his work, then I got to invent a whole body of work for him. So I had to think about what he might have made, what these pieces might have looked like, what might have influenced him in terms of where he lived or what time periods he was working in. So it was a fabulous opportunity for me to, through a book, make the kinds of art that I would have no talent for making.
Very interesting, though, that you should freely admit that it gave you the chance to be a sculptor, effectively. Although what you're doing is describing the works on the page rather than actually sculpting them out for us. Does that suggest that underneath all of the writing talent and the writing success is in fact this visual artist bursting to get out?
Absolutely not. I did art for my Leaving Cert and I really enjoyed it, but I really only got through because I was able to write about art well. I had very little talent for any of the drawing part. But right. I've always liked to wander into art galleries and just, you know, just look at the art if I'm passing through a city. So I'm drawn to art and it's a fascinating world.
And for sure then, so you've been writing about pieces of art from your Leaving Cert years. You write about specifically a very important work. Your fictional sculptor here is a man called Robert Locke. And Nessa, our lead character, who's getting over that difficulty in her marriage and in her family life, is planning this retrospective of Locke's work. One of the very important works that has to be considered in Locke's body of work is a piece called The Chalk Sculpture, which, of course, you, Danielle McLaughlin, have created, albeit in words. So how would you describe this piece to us, the Chalk Sculpture?
Well, I must thank Nuala O'Connor for the existence of the chalk sculpture, because back in 2012, I did a workshop that Nuala was giving at Waterford Writers' Weekend. And as part of the workshop, Nuala gave us a writing prompt. And in the writing prompt, I got a piece of broken pottery. And it was a piece small enough to sit in the palm of my hand. And I remember its chalkiness, its chalky white edges. And it was from that writing exercise and that piece of pottery that the piece of art in the novel that's called The Chalk Sculpture came into existence. And I actually tried to write The Chalk Sculpture as a short story for a couple of years. So I still have all these versions that I kept of short stories called The Chalk Sculpture. And they're all very different, but The Chalk Sculpture is in all of them. And The Chalk Sculpture is the constant in the development of the stories and later the novel. It's been there from the beginning.
Who would have thought that a small piece of crockery, of pottery, could have such an inspiring effect on you?
It was a wonderful workshop. So, as I say, my thanks to Nuala. Yeah, it was a very small piece of pottery. The sculpture in the novel is quite a large
absolutely piece of art. Yeah, go ahead and describe it, because there are very important aspects to this that open up a whole series of debates that are had within or between some of the characters of the novel.
Yeah, so it's a female form and it's partly abstract and it doesn't have a face. And the face hasn't been carved at all, but other parts of the sculpture have been carved in great detail. And there was a time when sculpture became very popular with the local community, when it was believed that it held fertility powers. And then for a long time, people would visit it and bring it gifts and offerings. So there was that whole story that grew up around that piece of sculpture. But as we see in the novel, it also holds other different stories, and those come to be revealed as the novel progresses.
Yeah, and I think I can give a hint to some of those without going too far down the route. First of all, Robert Locke's wife, Eleanor, who we do meet in the novel, she was an artist herself, or certainly had artistic abilities. And there's a student that comes back from Robert Locke's past, who again has knowledge around this particular item, this chalk sculpture. So the whole question of agency comes into play here, particularly a male sculpture, this piece of work around fertility as an important theme within it, and two women involved in possibly, certainly had some role in the creation of this particular piece of work. That aspect of agency, was that important to you, Danielle?
Well, one of the things that I found myself drawn to looking at as I was writing the novel was imbalances of power, imbalances of power within relationships and in society and within the art world. I think Robert Locke, my fictional sculptor, he produced lots of very good work. Was he a good person? I think he had a lot of flaws. And I think in lots of ways, he's one of the people in the novel who creates some messes that are left to other people to sort out.
Yeah, and as you say, this whole idea of imbalances of power within the art world, you could write about that freely in a fictional way. What about imbalances of power within the publishing world? Are there parallels there?
I suppose in any sector, I think we always have to be aware that there are possible imbalances. And one of the things that interests me is in this novel is how people perhaps cling to a particular version of a story without challenging it. And I like to think that, you know, it's always better when we're open to challenging things. So we can, you know, there's art and there's the people and the structures around that piece of art. So, yeah.
One other important thread within the novel itself is a past, an old friend of Nessa McCormick's, a woman called Amy Corrigan, and her son, and how they, you know, secrets from the past begin to seep their way into things. Well, and all three stories, in fact, if you like, Nessa and the family, the Robert Locke retrospective exhibition, and this old friend from the past, Amy Corrigan, they do all come together in the novel itself. That idea of a secret that has been held for a long, long time, is that really grist to the mill for the writer?
I think the idea of the past coming back in at the time when it is least wanted is great material for fiction, because sometimes we think we've put the past behind us and then it will ambush us. And I think there's various characters in this novel, some more so than others, who are ambushed by their past or who are carrying their past with them in ways that are impacting on their present. And I suppose there's the question, can we ever really regard the past as past, and can we ever very neatly package truth up and say, yes, this is it, and I have all the answers now?
There you go. Yes, and do we have all the answers now? That's what you'll find out if you read the novel, The Art of Falling. So, very successful debut collection of short stories, as I said, and now The Art of Falling out there and receiving some very good reviews along the way as well, Danielle. What's next? Is it a short? Are there a bundle of short stories waiting to come together, or is there a new novel?
Well, it's both. I've continued to write short stories, and I've also written a second novel that I'm working on redrafting. So I'm writing stories and the new novel alongside each other.
Well, we'll see which comes to the fore as time goes on. But thanks for speaking to us this evening, Danielle.
Thanks very much for having me on the programme.
That's Danielle McLaughlin speaking to us about her novel, The Art of Falling, which is published by John Murray. News just in, now three Irish authors have made the shortlist for the 2021 Rathbones Folio Prize, which was announced this evening in London. Sarah Baum for Handiwork, A Portrait of Her Life as an Artist. Elaine Feeney for her novel, As You Were. And Dhiridhni Graifa for her memoir, A Ghost in the Throat. Eight books were selected from a long list of 80. £30,000 sterling prize rewards. Quote, the best work of literature of the year, regardless of form. And it was set up in 2011 after a row in literary circles over the controversial decision by that year's Man Booker judges to focus on readability. This year's judges for the Rathbone Folio Prize are Roger Robinson, John McGregor and Sinead Gleeson. And according to the shortlist, 2021 is also a strong year for small and independent presses, not least our own Tramp Press, who published the books by both Sarah Baum and Dhiridhni Graifa. And the winner of the 2021 Rathbones Folio Prize will be announced on March 24th. This month, the Irish Film Institute has put together a special programme of classic cinema from Japan. The season, called Japanese Story, shows the depth and breadth of that country's rich cinematic culture. And it also makes clear the impact that Japanese filmmakers have had on global cinema, most especially Hollywood. John McGuire joins me now. John, we'll talk about the contents of the Japanese cinema programme from IFI at Home shortly, but I really want you to talk to me about the influence of Japanese film on Hollywood. People might think, don't really know that much about Japanese cinematic style, but if you've seen a Hollywood film, you probably do know quite a lot about it.
Yeah, Hollywood has always been a melting pot of film cultures and influence, whether it's the Middle Europeans who arrived in the 20s fleeing war and persecution, the British from the 30s onwards, or the Irish from the day they opened the doors. And Hollywood film culture has always been a global film culture. But there are occasions when the influence of one film culture is more keenly felt, like in the case of the Japanese cinema of the 1950s. Now, they'd been making films in Japan since the days of the silence, but the industry really took flight in the 50s with the emergence of filmmakers of global renown, like Yasujiro Otsu, who made Tokyo Story in 1953, Kenji Mitsugoshi, who made Sancho the Bailiff, a classic film in 1956, and the top of the pile, Akira Kurosawa.
He's probably Kurosawa.
Kurosawa was a...
Yeah, I was just going to say, he probably is the one whose influence we see in a lot of mainstream Hollywood films.
We do, because the film school group of young directors who emerged in Hollywood in the mid to late 1960s, people like George Lucas, Francis Ford Coppola, Martin Scorsese and Steven Spielberg among them, they were all huge Kurosawa fans. They travelled to visit his sets once they had become established filmmakers. They had Kurosawa come to visit them in Hollywood. Scorsese even acted in Kurosawa's second to last film, Dreams. And when he was writing Star Wars in the early 1970s, Lucas used as his template for the plot Kurosawa's 1958 period drama, The Hidden Fortress. And if I gave you the plot of The Hidden Fortress, you'd think I was talking about Star Wars. There's a princess whose kingdom has been destroyed, a dashing rogue who's trying to protect her, played by the great Toshiro Mifune, one of the great actors of global cinema, and two bumbling idiots, one tall, one short, the R2-D2, C-3PO characters. The connections to Star Wars are obvious, but to some extent, those connections have been exaggerated by film fans who think that they've uncovered some great big secret, and even by Lucas himself, because of the kudos that the association with Kurosawa brought him. But there's no denying that he took significant parts of it from Kurosawa, along with Kurosawa's signature horizontal wipes in the editing, which Star Wars became famous for. And he also borrowed a lot of the lightsaber stuff is from Japanese martial arts. The term Jedi came from the Japanese Jidaigeki, meaning period drama, and Darth Vader's costume and helmet at samurai battle armor. I mean, some of it is more obvious than others, but it's all there and it's a clear thread that you can identify.
And it's not very difficult, even in the title, to see the connection between Kurosawa's The Seven Samurai and The Magnificent Seven.
That's right. When John Sturges saw Seven Samurai had been released in Japan. It had travelled to a certain extent to Cannes and a few other of the European festivals. And then it hit the US. John Sturges saw it on release in the US and reimagined it immediately as a Western. And in 1960, with Yul Brynner and Steve McQueen, famously, if you've ever sat in on a wet bank holiday Monday, you've seen this film. And it's since been remade again with Denzel Washington and Chris Pratt. 4 years later, in 1964, Sergio Leone took Kurosawa's Yojimbo and turned that into another Western, A Fistful of Dollars, the film that launched his career and that of Clint Eastwood, his star. Kurosawa wasn't even asked for permission for the remake, and he successfully sued Leone then shortly afterwards, and he received a cut from the box office for a fistful of dollars, and said for the rest of his life that he made more money from that than he ever did from any of his other films.
There you go. Mind you, I mean, it's I suppose, foolish to think, oh yeah, Kurosawa started it all off. He had all these wonderful ideas in his head and he totally reinvented film. He himself, of course, was looking back, possibly, if you like, towards Hollywood and the likes of John Ford.
Of course he was. The Japanese cinema in the 1930s and 40s, before the war, pre-war, was all a Hollywood cinema, almost entirely Hollywood cinema. And Kurosawa, in his autobiography, Kurosawa talked about his father bringing him to the pictures. And his father was a massive John Ford fan, the John Ford Westerns, from the silent Westerns, indeed. They all made their way to Japan. So the influences on Kurosawa are Ford and Hollywood, and they form this perfect circle of ideas and plots, characters and archetypes that are being passed from one culture to another and then back again in this kind of cross-fertilization of film ideas. But the remakes and reimaginings and blatant thefts didn't stop with Kurosawa. James Cameron has never acknowledged the debt that Avatar, this multi-billion dollar sci-fi epic, we're going to see two more of them now in the next couple of years, that the debt that he owes to Hayao Miyazaki's Studio Ghibli, and in particular Princess Mononoke, their 1997 fantasy. But all of the Miyazaki signature motifs are in Avatar, this environmental destruction, the strong female heroine, a human trespasser entering this wilderness society who's selected by the magical elements and must fight the human oppressors who want to mine something precious out of the ground. I mean, it's literally a direct lift.
Well, but I suppose
Cameron never acknowledged it.
Yeah, well, but he would probably acknowledge that inspiration comes from many different places, and that just because it looks like something,
exactly,
yeah, and just because it looks like something doesn't mean that you put your hand into the film and took it out and said, "I'm just going to use that and say nothing."
No, so, absolutely not. But at the same time, when you have a culture that over the time, by the time that Avatar, everybody has seen Japanese cinema. Cinema had entered the mainstream very much in the late 90s and the 2000s, particularly with the films of somebody like Takeshi Kitano, the filmmakers that came out, the cult Japanese horror films like The Ring, The Grudge, Dark Water, all of these, which incidentally have been remade almost frame by frame with Hollywood stars in anglicized versions. But there was a time in the 2000s in particular when Japanese and Asian cinema had very strong distribution in the West, very strong distribution in the UK and Ireland, and we all got to see them. And that's dropped off a little bit over the last couple of years.
Talk to me a little bit about the influence of the manga classic, The Ghost in the Shell, how that influenced the Matrix film.
Well, the manga was it became a cult item. The Ghost in the Shell, there was quite a few of them that were released in the mid-1990s that travelled extraordinarily well. What you imagine to be a very peculiarly Japanese form of expression actually had this universal resonance with everybody. And they were beautifully made films. I'm thinking in particular of Akira, which was a smash hit. The Ghost in the Shell was a little less well known, and the Wachowski sisters saw it and took the inspiration for The Matrix from it. And in fact, when they were originally trying to get financing for it and they went to the producer, Joel Silver, they just showed him a VHS of The Ghost in the Shell and said, "We want to make this film in live action." And that was it. That was the pitch for this $50, $60 million film. And I suppose, how could you say no to that? It's such an impressive film to watch. And if you try to imagine it in live action, then a couple of years later, The Ghost in the Shell itself was subsequently remade as a direct adaptation with Scarlett Johansson in the lead role. And that was a decision that gave rise to all kinds of questions about whitewashing Caucasian actors into Asian roles and a whole other issue of cultural appropriation, which really doesn't have a lot to do with the kind of thread of cinema that's crossing over and back across the Pacific, the kind of thing that we're talking about. It's more of a cultural argument.
And what about the
social argument? But what about still at the same time.
What about the controversy over The Lion King? Is that similar?
Well, this is perhaps a more contentious one. And I mean, some people claim that Disney lifted sections of their smash hit animation. It was a massive film, and it has been subsequently a stage show. There was a sequel, and there's been a kind of a live action remake of it as well. And there was an argument that it had been taken, or heavily inspired by, will we say, from a 1960s Japanese cartoon TV show called Kimba the White Lion. But Disney would say any similarities are just part of the circle of life. But, you know, there are a lot of thematic and direct, you know, the action in the film, a lot of scenes and a lot of themes that are in Kimba the White Lion showed up again in The Lion King. But that one went to court and was argued over extensively.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think there's still an appeal that's been running for something like 15 years.
Let us leave that appeal.
We're not going to interfere in that.
Let us leave that appeal.
We'll leave that one there, yeah.
Yeah, to work out what it works out.
The circle of life, Sean.
Yeah, absolutely. So the special programme of films then put together by the IFI, 11 classics available to rent now via IFI at home. The ones that you've seen, first of all, Kurosawa is there.
Kurosawa's Seven Samurai is there from 1954, and if you've never seen it, you absolutely must. I mean, you might have seen The Magnificent Seven, but the original is just an extraordinary film to lose yourself in.
Yeah.
He's so alive. It's such a film that's so alive, even after 60, 70 years. When you watch it, the template for action cinema is there. Every beat of it is familiar to you, but you really never knew where it originally came from. So that's The Seven Samurai. That's one I would certainly watch.
Other significant classics that we're getting then from the 60s and 70s that you would suggest we keep our eyes out for? Our eyes open, perhaps, maybe.
Every couple of years, the Sight and Sound, the UK magazine, the UK film magazine does a global survey of what the best film ever made is, which is kind of a reductive argument, but that's a point for another day. But Tokyo Story, Otsu's Tokyo Story from 1953, which is a masterpiece, has snuck onto that list over the last couple of years. And it sets the template for the Japanese family film. They call it Shomin Geki, ordinary people film. films, they call them. That's how they call the genre. And it's a genre film is taken up more recently by Hirokazu Koreeda, where moral and philosophical questions are addressed through observing ordinary Japanese people in their homes. And in this case, the case of Tokyo Story, which is a heartbreaking film. An elderly rural couple travel to the heaving new metropolis of the city to visit their uncaring children. The kids are determined to forge these new non-traditional lives in the post-war, and the elderly couple are hanging on to the traditional way of life. It's a masterpiece. It really is an extraordinary emotional film. Part of it, Sean, is the Japanese culture is so strange to us. A lot of their traditions, a lot of their the way their social mores, a lot of the way that they live their lives, the way their lives are structured, are so alien to us. But at the same time, they feel the same things that we do, and their filmmakers want to express the same emotions that we want to see here in the West. And that communication, that universality, is really very touching. And Tokyo Story, you can't get better than that.
Yeah, and I know there are others that you have seen as well that you would recommend, not least of which is The Iron Man from 1989, Hannah B. from 1997. But let's talk about ones that you're looking forward to seeing. When a Woman Ascends the Stairs.
Yeah, I'm going to embarrass myself, Sean, because I've never seen Mikio Naruse's When a Woman Ascends the Stairs. So I'm going to have to hand in my film critic credentials, because everybody should have seen this film. And it was the height of Japanese realism. A beautiful, I have to read this because, like I say, I've never seen the film. A beautiful yet broken widow, Keiko, played by Hideko Takamine, who is a very famous Japanese actress, struggled to maintain a financial and personal freedom. And it came at a time in the 1960s when women were trying to establish their independence in a male-dominated society, which is still very much a male-dominated society. And Naruse, which was a master, really, it's his vision of Japanese society is very exacting and profoundly emotional. And, but I've never seen it, so I will be tuning in for that one.
Yeah, and you'll get your card back when you've seen it. Don't worry. Other that you haven't seen and that you're recommending then to us from the season, John.
Well, there is a director called Masayuki Suo who's made quite a number of films. So he, in 1984, his debut feature, they have a genre, they're very good at classifying film in Japan, and they have another genre which they call pink film, which is kind of, I don't want to say soft core porn, but they feature a lot of nudity. We'll put it that way.
All right.
And Abnormal Family.
Right. Well, we'll let people tune in or go to the IFI at Home website and
find out a bit more about
pink
Abnormal
film
Family
and what it means. John McGuire, thanks very much for that. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Cullen was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGann. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio.